All right, we'll call this meeting of the House Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. The clerk will note the roll. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes. Representative Hilty will move the minutes from the March 2nd meeting. Are there any additions, corrections, amendments to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. All right, members, the first bill on the agenda is going to be House File 572, Representative Johnson's bill regarding methamphetamines.
Thank you.
Okay,
Mr.
Representative Johnson, Chairman Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House File 572 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
Okay. Chairman Johnson, is the bill currently in the form in which you'd like to discuss it, or do you have any amendments prior to your discussion and presentation of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move both of these amendments to put it in the form that I would prefer.
All right. Which is the First Amendment?
Let's do the A8 Amendment first, since it's nice and short.
Okay.
This is an amendment that came from the Bankers Association. We may want to add more questions to this after we open up discussion on the bill, but essentially what this does is it tracks what current environmental law is with respect to cleanup requirements and says that if a bank, for example, becomes the owner of real property simply through foreclosure, they don't have the same cleanup obligations as would someone else, a different property owner. So I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay. Chairman Johnson, wait a moment. Members, do we have that amendment? Does everybody have that?
I don't have that.
I don't either.
I have it. Mine says A8.
Okay, let's take the second question first. And does everyone have the A9 amendment?
Yes.
Okay, we have an A9 amendment. We do not have an A8 amendment.
Sure.
Ms. McKnight has that. Will hopefully shed some light on this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the A8 and the A9 amendments are the same, and I'm sorry to say the A8 was drafted to the first engrossment, and then the second engrossment came out. It just changes the lines, and I'm sorry that you didn't get a separate copy.
That's fine.
It's probably in your folder up here, and I just didn't actually get it in your hands.
That's fine. So I'll move the A9 amendment.
Okay. So for the record, Chairman Johnson, the author withdraws the A8 amendment, and now we now have the A9 amendment before us. To the amendment, Chairman Johnson.
It's the same, this is based on the bankers, and they would be happy to answer questions about it, but I'd like to get it in front of us if we could.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves the A9 amendment. Is there any discussion at this time, noting that we will discuss it in detail here shortly? Seeing no, proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to move the A05-0139 amendment, which is the longer amendment. But I need to make a couple changes to it before we vote on it.
Okay.
And this amendment was brought to us by the Realtors Association. They have been working with the real property section of the bar, as well as, I believe, some other groups. And I'm going to ask Susan Diori, once we get to this portion, to actually walk through this amendment, but it deals with real property provisions in the bill. Mr. Chairman, can I tell you what I need to orally change before we vote on this?
Let's do that. Before we get to that question, members, do you have the amendment in front of you? I see some inquisitive looks. Which amendment was that again?
This is the A05 amendment.
The A05 amendment. Okay. I don't know if I do. Bear with me for a minute.
It's 6 or 7 pages long.
Okay, A05-0139?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody's got it? All right, Chairman Johnson, you have some oral amendments to make to the amendment.
Yes.
Proceed.
If you go to page 3, starting on line 26, this happens 4 different times in the amendment, and there's essentially a provision that says a contractor needs to verify cleanup of a lab site, and one thing it is requiring the contractor to verify is that levels of contamination have been reduced to levels set forth in some health department guidelines. Those guidelines do not set forth levels, so we can't require the contractor to do it, so essentially it's just a mistake. So starting on line 26, page 3, the word "and," you would delete "and best practices," and that levels of contamination have been reduced to levels set forth in the guidelines. Retain the period.
Okay.
That happens 3 other places in the bill, in the amendment. Also on page 3, line 34, about halfway across, delete "or the levels of contamination were not reduced to levels set forth in the guidelines." page 4, line 2, about halfway across, starting with and, you delete and reducing the levels of contamination to levels set in the guidelines. And then page 6, line 23, again about halfway across the word and, you would delete and best practices and that levels of contamination have been reduced to levels set forth in the guidelines. I apologize for that mistake, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Ms. McKnight is the scribe and keeper of all our documents. Have you tracked all those oral amendments?
Mr. Chair, I think I haven't.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I have one more change. One more oral change.
So I'm going
on page 6, line 27. It has a 2-year statute of limitations. We're trying to track what the Senate passed off the floor, and they passed 6. So the word 2 on line 27 should read 6.
That do it for your oral amendments, Chairman Johnson?
Yes.
All right, we'll proceed to vote on the oral amendments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The amendments are adopted. Chairman Johnson, to the A05 amendment.
I will actually, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is just walk through the 2 or 3 pieces of the bill that I think will be of interest to this committee. I've had 3 stops and have 3 or 4 more to go. But there are some real property provisions as well as a immunity provision and a data practices provision. If I could just point those out, then I'll turn it over.
Would you like to adopt the A05 amendment before doing that or after?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we just did that.
No. We adopted the amendments to the amendment.
Okay.
Now we have the A05 amendment before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The A05 amendment is now adopted. Chairman Johnson, your bill.
Thank you. The portions that I think are relevant to this discussion, if you go to page 2, starting on line 22, that is the Schedule 5 provision, the piece of the bill that's probably the most controversial, and what that requires is that certain pseudoephedrine products can only be sold by a pharmacist or a pharmacist technician. An individual can only buy 2 packages of up to 6 grams at one time. And can only buy 6 grams over a 30-day period. Now, 6 grams is approximately 7 to 8 of your average-sized Sudafed boxes. So that's 7 to 8 boxes in a 30-day period. An individual must prove that he or she is 18 years old with a photo ID, and the piece that I think would be of interest to this committee, an individual must sign a log with their name and address every time they buy a pseudoephedrine product. There are exceptions to this. Gel caps or soft gels aren't covered. Liquid products aren't covered, and pediatric products aren't covered. But the log has, we may have some data practices or data privacy issues with that. Then, if we skip back to page 13, line 32, essentially this is a provision, this is currently in law, it's been recodified, but I want to point it out because this committee may have an interest in it. It says if you're illegally tampering with someone else's anhydrous ammonia, you can't sue them if you get hurt for it, in essence. That is currently in the law, but we've recodified it, and I wanted to point that out in case someone spotted it and thought it was new. The other portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that will be of interest to committee members is the amendment, the A05 amendment, and that is has to do with the real property provisions. And essentially what that did, it completely replaced Section 7, which starts on page 8, line 11. And what I will ask to do, maybe after Mr. O'Malley testifies and gives us somewhat of an overview about meth and Schedule 5, is I'll ask Susan Diori from the Realtors Association to come down and walk through that amendment for you, since that's where it came from.
Yeah. Hey, Chairman Johnson and members, I think what we'll do here, since I anticipate a large amount of questions today, what we're going to do is we'll let all the witnesses first testify to give them ample opportunity to speak their piece. So I ask that you hold your questions until we've had an opportunity to hear from all the witnesses, and then we'll engage in a discussion and a colloquy, if needed, on the bill. Chairman Johnson, your first witness?
My first witness is Tim O'Malley from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. He has a short video to show us, which I think is interesting, and then some testimony on meth in general.
Okay. Mr. O'Malley, if you'd first identify yourself for the record, then we'll move to your video.
My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Big news of the day. 2 minutes away now, but first, it's America's fastest growing drug, methamphetamine. Accounting for one of every five federal drug arrests, meth is also one of the fastest growing problems for police. But cops and lawmakers are saying they've come up with a few ways to try to stop it from spreading. In a Fox report now from Steve Brown.
From babies born addicted to methamphetamine, to teenagers who die using meth, to the spread of meth-related crimes, there is a steep price for America's growing meth use. Nationally, meth arrests are up, and the number of meth users sent to prison is up, too.
It's dangerous, isn't it?
Very dangerous.
I take it you didn't care.
No, not at all. I was out getting high. All I cared about was getting high.
In the Minnesota prison system alone, the number of meth inmates has gone up fivefold in 4 years. Once behind bars, some get drug treatment, which costs money. So does fixing meth mouth, the term for the rotting teeth of meth users.
They're pretty bad. I knew it wasn't making my teeth go ill, but I didn't really care, I guess, because I was, you know, wanted to be high instead.
The methamphetamine problem is costing Minnesota taxpayers somewhere between $170 and $190 million a year.
And meth is a problem almost everywhere, and it's why more than 20 states may copy Oklahoma. Last year, Oklahoma lawmakers clamped down on cold medicines containing pseudoephedrine. It's the critical ingredient in making meth, and it's needed in bulk. Oklahoma moved all pseudoephedrine remedies behind the pharmacist's counter. Quantities are limited. Buying it requires a photo ID and a signature. Result? Meth lab busts are down in Oklahoma a startling 80%.
This has worked in Oklahoma, Steve. The problem is that they've gone over the border into Missouri and places like that.
That do not have Oklahoma's pseudoephedrine restrictions. But two U.S. senators, Republican Jim Talent of Missouri and California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, are proposing a new federal law which would make Oklahoma's restrictions on pseudoephedrine medications the law of the land, and hoping to keep the costs of America's meth mess from spiraling higher.
Tonight, the iTeams Ben Tracy shows us how Minnesota's war on meth is now being fought at a store near you.
Welcome. Please scan your first item.
Cold medicine isn't something most of us get real excited about. Not so for David Osborne.
When I saw a roll of pseudoephedrine, I thought we're gonna have a party.
Pseudoephedrine is the key ingredient in products like Sudafed. We use it to clear up our stuffy noses. When Target surveillance cameras caught David buying a basket full of boxes, store security figured he was using it for something else.
We went in, we bought like 17, 18 boxes at one crack.
The store called the police. They found enough cold medicine in David's car to unclog the noses of 350 people.
We were just being idiots that day.
David didn't have a cold. He had what a growing number of Minnesotans have, an addiction to methamphetamine.
Pretty much took my life and ripped it apart.
Pseudoephedrine is the main ingredient in meth cooked up by addicts in home meth labs. The number of labs in Minnesota has tripled in the past 4 years. From crackdown to cleanup, meth is straining county budgets, hooking our kids, and costing you millions in tax dollars.
Thank you for shopping at Walmart.
Most major retailers now voluntarily limit the number of boxes we can buy.
I can only sell three of them.
Oh! Why?
They have pseudoephedrine in there, and you can use that to make drugs, I think.
But Paul Stevens, our narcotics agent for the state, says box limits are not slowing down meth cooks.
Simply just go to different stores or keep going into the same store, in and out, in and out.
So we tested that loophole. Target has a two-box limit. We went in and out of the same store buying 12 boxes in 30 minutes.
So if I wanted to buy more, would I come back and buy it again? Per transaction.
At Walmart, the limit is three. We bought 15 boxes in 45 minutes, going in and out of the same store five times. In less than an hour and a half, we bought enough pseudoephedrine to keep one person high for 2 months.
Most states have not found a good way to deal with the meth problem. So we came here to Oklahoma to see what they're doing, because some say this is the one state that may have found a solution.
It's really a simple solution to a simple problem.
Lonnie Wright heads Oklahoma's Bureau of Narcotics. A year ago, his state was busting 100 meth labs a month.
We spent hundreds of millions of tax dollars doing that and had absolutely no success.
So last April, Oklahoma passed a law, making it harder for meth cooks to get cold medicine. The state classified pseudoephedrine as a Schedule 5 drug, basically a controlled substance. These boxes had to be moved from regular shelves to the pharmacy. To buy them, you have to show an ID and sign your name in a log that can be reviewed by state agents. The law is working. Oklahoma has seen up to an 80% drop in the number of meth labs since it went into effect.
If you don't have pseudoephedrine, you can't manufacture methamphetamine.
22 other states are now considering laws similar to Oklahoma, including Minnesota.
And if we're the only state in the upper Midwest that does not have Schedule 5, we are going to be in a world of hurt.
We just have an honest difference of opinion.
Buzz Anderson represents Minnesota's retailers. They now support a law making a two-box limit mandatory, but not the other restrictions.
Stores don't want to go through that hassle. More importantly, they don't want to inconvenience their customers who are legitimate users of these products.
Having to visit a pharmacy and sign a log to buy cold medicine may not be popular, but meth experts say any other restrictions are meaningless.
And these are simple things. But if we did these things, we would see a significant drop in methamphetamine manufacturing at home by drug addicts in the state of Minnesota.
Target and Walmart declined on-camera interviews. At the Capitol, Target has been actively fighting to keep pseudoephedrine on the shelves where it is now.
Do you think some of these stores know that they're making a lot of money off selling this stuff to meth addicts?
Oh, absolutely. It was only those who stood to gain from the continued sale of their products that was against this.
Retailers won't release sales figures, but state experts estimate that Minnesota meth cooks could be spending $13 million each year on pseudoephedrine.
It's not about profit. We, in fact, want to do what's the right public policy.
It's a powerful drug.
David Osborne is serving 8 years in prison. He's not sure what the solution is. He does know when he gets out, he'll be more like the rest of us.
Is this for you, though?
Not so excited about shopping for this.
At today's hearings, lawmakers played our I-Team investigation from last night, in which we showed you that meth addicts are using cold products containing pseudoephedrine to make their drugs. The state Senate's Public Safety Committee took testimony today about a proposed law to cut down on meth making in Minnesota. The law would move pseudoephedrine products from the regular shelves to behind pharmacy counters, impose a mandatory limit of 2 boxes per purchase, and require you to show an ID and sign your name in a log. You would not need a prescription, and most gel caps and pediatric forms would be exempt. Major retailers do not support these restrictions. Now, since our story aired last night, more than 1,000 of you have taken our online poll about this legislation. 93% say you support the restrictions. 7% are against it.
Sheriff's office!
There's a methamphetamine epidemic in the nation's heartland, and the raw ingredient fueling it is cold medicine from the corner store.
We are following a pill stopper.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee on the methamphetamine situation in Minnesota. Representative Johnson has asked me to give an overview for the committee. I know that some of you have been at other committees and have testified about this issue. I'll try to move fairly quickly through this PowerPoint presentation, especially at the beginning, which just covers the sort of general situation here in Minnesota. It goes back a little bit, shows where we've been, where we're at now, and likely where we could be going, and then focus a little bit more on the Schedule 5 and the pseudoephedrine issue at the end. I'm not going to talk too much about individual effects, but as everyone I think knows from just the media and even from maybe in your own communities, in your own churches, in your own schools, your children, you've seen what the effect of meth can have on people. There are severe consequences for abusing meth. Children are found in most of the meth labs, or about half of the meth labs here in Minnesota. They're living in conditions like this. This is not unusual, if you will, for a meth lab to have it be really horrendous conditions that children are exposed to. Weapons are often found at meth sites, methamphetamine labs certainly, but even meth users. One consequence, one characteristic of being a meth abuser is to be paranoid. You don't trust your own family. You don't trust relatives. You don't trust neighbors, and you certainly don't trust the police. They think we're after them, and in fact, we are. They live in a very dangerous world. There are people that will rip them off. They deal with cash. They deal with drugs. So there's, in a way, a good reason that they would have weapons, but that is a result of the meth use in the state. Meth labs, forget about what they're making even. Pretend they're making something other than meth. The meth lab process itself is extremely dangerous. These labs blow up. There are fires. Children have died. People have been injured very seriously. The environmental concerns that I think you're all aware of, there's just a very dangerous set of circumstances that come together. The conditions in meth labs just breed problems across the board. Environmental, family, children, the whole bit. 4 years ago, I came to the legislature and testified about the meth issue here in Minnesota. This is one of the slides I used at that time. I would just point out a couple of things. You can note Missouri, where they've gone. You hear a lot about Missouri, and I'll show you some stats about them in a minute. But if you look and compare Iowa with Minnesota, back in 95, Iowa had 8, Minnesota had 13. We were tracking about equal. Went that way for a few years, and then Iowa really started to skyrocket on us. And you can see some of the other Midwestern states. Look at Wisconsin. There was a tendency when I testified back then, we could see it happen in California, and just you could just follow the map. Every year you would see more and more meth labs moving across from west to east, and Wisconsin is facing it now. Here's what's happened since then in Minnesota. These are the DEA statistics for the number of meth labs seized in Minnesota from 95 through 2003. We just point out that this is a very, very conservative number. There are more meth labs than this, and more meth labs have been seized than this. But these are the ones that have been officially reported to DEA and ones in which federal funding was used for the cleanup. There are a lot of effects of on government, in particular government agencies, on the cost of methamphetamine labs and methamphetamine in general. Here is the number of items of evidence submitted to our laboratory over the past 5-6 years, and you can see the spike in the last few years regarding meth. Other agencies have been affected, other public sector agencies. Meth treatment admissions, you can see, are up almost 300% in the last 4 years or so. That's from the Department of Human Resources. Meth adult court filings. These are criminal cases in adult court. None of the juvenile cases. This doesn't address that at all, but up over 700% in the last few years. The meth prison population, I'm sure all members of the legislature are familiar with that and concerned about the DOC's numbers, but they're up significantly. And then the last two are from the drug task forces around the state. There are 22 drug task forces around Minnesota, local law enforcement officers. These are statistics from them about the number of arrests and the number of meth labs in the last few years. Here's where some of the money goes. Speaking broadly, you heard the Commissioner of Public Safety on the video talk about it costing $170 to $190 million. This is that breakdown. And we have a report that I'd be happy to share with you that gives the background to this, the calculations that led to these numbers. The cost in 2004 was $176 million conservatively, breaking this down. The ongoing cost is estimated to be $130 million per year if nothing else changes. I point out two factors about this information. One is that it includes nothing from the juvenile court system. And there's a lot of this in the juvenile court system, but none of those costs are in here. Secondly, none of the costs for associated or related crimes, crimes related to methamphetamine. These are purely methamphetamine drug cases. These are not the murders, the rapes, the burglaries, the thefts, the robberies, and a whole slew of other crimes that have been taking place that are done by meth addicts, meth dealers, and abusers. For law enforcement in particular, there's a, it's a very painstaking and dangerous task to go in and take care of any lab, no matter how big or small they are. They are dangerous environments. There's hazardous material. It takes a lot of training, a lot of equipment, a lot of supplies. It's a very time-consuming endeavor to get ready to go in and then to clean up afterwards to follow all the OSHA requirements, which we do. Here's a little closer look at Iowa, Missouri, and Oklahoma. I showed you the slide from a few years ago. This is now, in the last few years, you can see what's happened in terms of meth lab seizures in these states that are nearby. Oklahoma, you'll see the drop at the end there, the red bars dropping down. I'll get to that in a moment. But Iowa and Missouri are dealing with the problem. We are now in Minnesota, back in that 1999 area. We're under 500 a year. This could be where we're heading. You know, time will tell, but that's about where we're at now, and you see what's happened in some other states. Pseudoephedrine, as we mentioned in the video, is the absolute essential ingredient. There are others that can be substituted. You can use other products, but if you don't have pseudoephedrine, you cannot make methamphetamine, period. That's the end of it. I brought some of these boxes along. Here's the one that's shown on there. This box contains, as it says, 24 tablets of 30 milligrams each. From this box, a person could make methamphetamine in a matter of a couple hours and end up with 3/4 of a gram. That's enough for a long weekend for a moderate user of methamphetamine. That's just one box. You can see the calculations. I won't walk through them now, but the limits that Representative Johnson has proposed are very reasonable. If somebody needs this for legitimate health reasons, they can purchase these two boxes, which is, according to the instructions on the back, a 6-day supply. After 6 days, the instructions say, see your doctor, discontinue use. Secondly, that's just buying two boxes at a time. You can buy 7 or 8 boxes in a 30-day period. You can have these at home. I don't know that people use them that often, but you can have them at home in your medicine cabinet for a year and still use them later. But you can have enough around to take care of that weekend, that unusual 2 in the morning situation that comes up with you or your children. Here, just to illustrate, because I can't grasp this without a visual, I'll tell you. This is why pseudoephedrine is an essential ingredient to methamphetamine. Here's the molecular structure for pseudoephedrine: hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen molecules. If you take those two molecules away, and this is the process that they go through, and you replace that hydrogen molecule again, you have methamphetamine. That's the only difference between pseudoephedrine and methamphetamine. So it's a relatively simple process. It involves some extraction and it involves some working, but it can be done. Why Schedule 5? Why the focus on pseudoephedrine? Missouri, if you recall the numbers from that, Missouri has failed. They will be the first to tell you they have absolutely failed in their efforts to curtail the number of meth labs. They have tried. They have tried other approaches that they thought were reasonable and would be effective. In 2001, their legislature passed a law that limited the purchases to 9 grams or 3 packages. They had about 2,100 labs that year. The next year, labs went up 29% despite that legislation. The next year, in response to their inability to curtail the number of labs, they then limited the purchases to 6 grams and had it either behind the counter or in plain view of the counter in an effort to deter thefts. I mean, that's part of the way these cooks get it. Again, the labs went up another 9% despite that legislation. Oklahoma, here's a closer look that was referred to a moment ago. You can see where the labs were at, well over 1,000 a year for several in a row. And then in 2004, it dropped significantly. The reason why? Oklahoma in April of 2004 went to Schedule 5. They went to the restrictions that are proposed by Representative Johnson in this bill. That has resulted over a period of time of a 61% average reduction. And as I'll go through here in a moment, there's the 80% is the current reduction, and it appears to be the current reduction in labs in Oklahoma. This bar graph shows the monthly lab seizures in Oklahoma for 2003 and 2004. In 2003, just to walk through that one, in January, if you compare it, January of 2005, 2003 as the black bars going across. So in January of 2005, they had 105. And you can see the black bars dip a little and then go up. You go to 2004, the white bar next to it now, that's 121 in January of 2004. And then you see the white bars again. In April, that's when they passed that bill that made it a Schedule 5, put it behind the counter, pharmacist, ID, age 18, sign a log. The result, very dramatic. Immediately, the next month, down 39%, 45, 54, continues on until December, comparing December of 2003 with December of 2004, 78% reduction in the number of meth labs seized in Oklahoma that month. It was referred to in the video, one gentleman from Missouri talked about it. Right now, what Oklahoma's seeing, they share a border with Missouri. What they're seeing is that there's been an influx of crooks or crook activity into Missouri from Oklahoma because it's difficult to get the pseudoephedrine in Oklahoma. So that's one of the reasons that Missouri has seen this huge increase. Oklahoma is much safer today, and Missouri is much less safe today because of the Oklahoma legislation. There's talk frequently about the inconvenience factor of doing this, and it is. There's an inconvenience associated with the proposal. There's talk that customers won't be satisfied with this. They would rather not do this. There's a study that was done at the University of Northern Iowa that talked about how much of an inconvenience would it be to you if they put quantity limits, so you can only buy the 6 grams or the 2 packages at a time. The result was that 85% either said no inconvenience or a very small inconvenience. Second question was, what if you had to show a photo ID? Would that bother you compared to, how much of an inconvenience would that be compared to not having that? Again, 83%, 67% said no inconvenience, a small amount said be an inconvenience, 16%. The last question they asked was, what if you had to go to a pharmacist? Again, this time 75% found it to be not really an inconvenience to do that. And then the last one I'll mention is the WCCO poll. This is an unscientific poll. This is in response to the video that you saw. For the next 24 hours, people could go online and record their vote. 93% were in favor of the restrictions proposed. There is always a balance between public safety and inconvenience to the private sector. Between public safety and individual rights. I mean, these are balances that are dealt with by the legislature and by the judiciary all the time. I think that in some other states there have been defining moments that have led to some legislation. You've heard a fair amount about Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, what happened was 3 Oklahoma state troopers were shot and murdered by methamphetamine users and addicts, not in all one incident, but they had 3 of them within a year. That served as the catalyst in Oklahoma for this legislation. In Indiana recently, they are moving towards Schedule 5. It's not there now. It's being debated. There was a young girl who was murdered in a Crothersville, Indiana, a town of 1,600 people. I looked at a map this weekend. It's down south of Columbus, Little Ways. Her name is Katie Coleman, and I'll just read you a couple quick things out of the media on it. The death of Caitlin Coleman, whose body was found in a creek 5 days after an Amber Alert was issued from her disappearance. She was not killed because of a sexual assault, a kidnapping for ransom, or random violence. She was killed because she stumbled across a meth lab in her neighborhood. The 10-year-old's body was found on January 30th in a creek. That's January 30th, just a month or so ago. In a creek several miles from her home. Her hands were tied behind her back. The cause of death was drowning. Reverend John Pierce told the crowd at her funeral that this death should serve, quote, as a wake-up call. If Katie hadn't been walking by a meth lab, she would be alive today, he said. The person charged with this crime said his intent was to intimidate her from revealing that a meth lab was being made, that methamphetamine was being made in an apartment near her home. There have been a lot of situations in Minnesota, and I'd just like to cover a couple of them now. We have not had situations like those 3. We haven't had 3 police officers shot and killed in Minnesota last year. We haven't had a 10-year-old girl murdered because she happened to stumble across a meth lab, a totally innocent little girl. But we have had a few situations. Not long ago in Goodwill, Minnesota, methamphetamine deal, the dealers took the buyer who owed him money, put him in the trunk of the car, took him out in the woods, were going to dump him. spur of the moment, one of the dealers grabbed a hatchet that was in the trunk of the car and buried in his head, killed him. Down in Fountain, Minnesota, a man was cooking methamphetamine and fire started. He died in the fire. Long Prairie in Minneapolis, I would suspect everyone recalls that one. It was Carpenter and Earl were the two criminals. They, one of them broke into a home in Minneapolis, killed the father and his adult disabled daughter. They went back and then burglarized the house. About a week or 10 days later, they went up to Long Prairie, small town, central northern Minnesota. Absolute 100% random choice of a home. Went into the home. The mother was sleeping on the couch. It was in the middle of the night. Her teenage children, a boy and a girl, were sleeping in their rooms respectively. The two of them went in there. These three people were murdered, were tortured, were forced to listen and watch while other family members were being murdered and being assaulted. It was a horrendous crime, and meth was at the middle of it. Pillager was a triple homicide in a trailer outside Brainerd. Again, it was a methamphetamine environment, if you will. It was meth users, meth sellers. Absolutely brutal murder scene. Our crime scene team was up there. The woman in her 20s was assaulted in unspeakable ways before she died. All three were murdered by a shot. In Elizabeth, Minnesota, was a mother who was a meth user. There was a meth lab, or materials for a meth lab in the house. She was away from the house for a short period of time. There was a fire in the house and two children died. Grove City, while we haven't had a police officer murdered, we've had some very close calls. There was an assault in a search warrant executed in Grove City, and as they were going up, the meth dealer reached for a gun. They ended up having to arrest him. He ended up being convicted of attempted murder of a sheriff's deputy. A short time later, he committed suicide. The meth dealer and user did. And this was a person who I talked to the sheriff up there. This was a person who was really an upstanding member of the community. He was a married guy with kids and a couple years ago got into methamphetamine, and this was the result. Ended up with attempted murder charges and suicide. Gilbert, Minnesota, another meth deal that went bad. A couple dealers grabbed a guy that owes him some money in Little Gilbert, throw him in the trunk, drive him around for 18 hours total, beat him up. When his body was found, the next day he's got 10 bullet holes in his head. There's another one where officers came under fire as they were about to execute a search warrant at a meth lab. A SWAT team was there. The meth cook was under the influence, came out with a shotgun, opened fire on the officers. He was shot and killed. There's a whole slew of them around the state. In Eagan, there's 12 and 14-year-old girls that were molested. In Burnsville, by a meth user or a meth dealer. In Burnsville, there was a young 16-year-old girl died of a meth overdose, but before dying, she was raped. We've had informants murdered in the state for cooperating with the police. The case in Ramsey that got a fair amount of attention. The totally random shooting of a couple people. Last slide. In conclusion, you've seen, I think, a few of these before and afters. Here it is. There are, I would suggest, reasonable alternatives available on the shelves. These are some of them, gel caps, other things. These, by the way, would not be affected at all by this legislation. This has 30 milligrams of pseudoephedrine. This has 60 milligrams. These would be out there at any convenience store 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anywhere in Minnesota. There's no effects. So pseudoephedrine would be available for those who have colds and have a medicinal use, and these have the exact same effect as some of the others. I think you will hear that sometimes some of these approaches are not reasonable or haven't been proven to be effective. There are some things out there, MethWatch and some other programs, and there are some people who oppose this bill. And I have a lot of respect for their opinion, and I know that they're well-intended. We just disagree on this. MethWatch is a phenomenal program. It's been a great program. We would hope to continue to use that in Minnesota, but it is not the answer. It alone won't do it. And okay, unless there's any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. We'll hold off on questions at this time. Chairman Johnson, I have got on our witness list Ms. Diori next.
Yes, that would be great.
True. Ms. Diori, I see you're here amongst us today. Good afternoon.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Ms. Diori to briefly walk through the amendment, the AO5 amendment, because that did come from transfer organization.
Yes, Ms. Viore, if you would identify yourself for the record and then briefly walk us through the A05 amendment.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Susan Dior, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. With me is Chuck Parsons, and he is the chair for the real property section of the bar, and we worked on this amendment together along with other interested parties. I will, instead of going through the entire amendment, what I will do is just mention what we have changed from the original language in the bill. Starting on page 2 of the amendment, lines 27 through 30, we modify the definition of property just to try to make it more clear and understandable. No substantive changes there. Page 3, line 4, you will see that we added language stating that the local health department sheriff shall order that any property or a portion of a property that has been found to be a lab site could not be occupied or used. Two issues in this paragraph. First, we felt that in the event, for example, if there was a circumstance where the methamphetamine lab was found in a house that was on a farmland, for example, that the health department could state that that home where the meth lab was actually found could not be used or occupied versus the farmland, which could still be rented or used. So we wanted to state that they could only list a portion of that property instead of the entire property. In addition to that, we eliminated the reference to rented or sold under this section. The reason being that it'd be almost impossible, if not impossible, to be able to regulate that if somebody were to actually rent or sell a property. It could also be detrimental to the property owner. If, for example, the property owner could not afford to remediate a meth lab, but they wanted to, in fact, sell it, with full disclosure, obviously, then that person would have prohibited them from being able to do that. So we feel that the regulation should be on the occupation or use of the property. On lines 12 to 14 there, we added language to make certain that a contractor would, in fact, have to do the remediation. So in other words, a property owner could not do it on their own. On line 23, we just added property owner so that the contractor had to verify to either the property owner and the applicable authority that they remediated the work. On lines 28 to 31, we tried to set a time period that the contractor would have to provide the property owner and the applicable authority with a verification that they did in fact remediate it. We set that at 5 days from the completion of the remediation. And in addition to that, we put in some liability language for the contractor. If in fact they did not remediate as they had certified according to the guidelines, they would be liable to the property owner for remediation of the property according to the guidelines and for reasonable attorney's fees. Further down on line 22, we added that the affidavit should contain the name of the owner as well as the legal description of the property. And we also added that they would draw a map, a simple map. We took this concept from the well disclosure requirements. They also have to have a map disclosing the location of the well, simply drawing it of the contaminated area of the property. On line 35 and 36, if there's an inaccurate drawing or description, the applicable authority would file a supplemental affidavit correcting the drawing or description, and once the authority vacates the order, they have to record an affidavit that contains the recording information, and upon filing the affidavit vacating the order along with the affidavit that was filed originally, together those information would cease to constitute either actual or constructive notice. And I'll let Chuck speak to that if you have any specific questions regarding that. On lines 11 through 16, again, we're just talking about constructive notice there. And it also, any failure to record that affidavit under the section would not affect the transfer of the property. Lines 28, we also added the name of the owner under there as well. And in addition to the current disclosure requirements for both real estate licensees and for seller disclosures, other interested parties felt that an additional disclosure was necessary, so we came to some consensus language beginning on line 34 and going all the way to the end of the next page, which would essentially require that any property owner for any type of property, whether that's commercial or residential property, would be required to disclose in writing to a prospective buyer if they were aware that methamphetamine production had had or had not occurred on the property. And then obviously they would have to disclose whether or not there was an order issued on the property, if they've been vacated, and whether or not the property has been remediated. And if they fail to do that, they fail to make that disclosure, they are liable to the buyer for cleanup of those of the methamphetamine lab and for reasonable attorney's fees. And then in addition to that, we just modified the effective date to be effective January 1 of this section, to be effective January 1 of 2006, so that we could educate our members.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Diori. Mr. Parsons, do you have anything to add to Ms. Diori's comments at this time?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, not at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Thank you, Ms. Diori. We will, if you'll stick around in case members have questions of you later on, we will move on in the witness list to Joe Witt. Is Mr. Witt here today?
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Witt,
Chairman Johnson,
he may have something he wants to say, but I think he's more here to answer questions about the First Amendment that we passed.
Okay. Yeah, well, no, for the record, Mr. Witt is here solely to answer questions should members have them. Thank you, Mr. Witt. We'll note your presence and call on you if needed. Next on the list is Twyla Braze. Ms. Braze, are you here with us today? Yes. Come on down. Good afternoon, Ms. Braze. If you would identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly, thank you. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I have something here if the page wants to pass it out. Our organization understands the concern about meth labs, but we're concerned about the constitutionality of Article 1, Section 2. And so on the form that you're going to get, you'll have our the eight things that we want you to keep in mind. And, oh, and I forgot to hand you one, I'm sorry. Anyway, we want you to understand that Sudafed is a legal over-the-counter product, and this bill does not propose to change that. That this bill will require registration for use of a legal over-the-counter medication. The law that will be used will contain private medical information. The bill is silent on format, which means it could be paper or electronic. And the Senate bill authorizes either. The House bill is silent on police access to the law, but the Senate bill authorizes it without a search warrant for 2 years. Essentially, this deputizes a portion of the healthcare system and makes it useful for the police. This unfettered police access lends itself to possible fishing expeditions, particularly with electronic logs. And I have been informed that the possibility exists that indeed there will be amendments to have this sort of police access on the House bill as well. The fishing expeditions could lead to tagging or targeting of law-abiding citizens, and this would be a violation of Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure without a search warrant. I have on your document, just in case you haven't read it for a long time, don't remember what it says, the Fourth Amendment, and the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause authorized by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So what I'd like you to think about for the future is that this bill is precedent-setting. That means that this legislation, if passed, will likely lead to similar legislation but on other products. So imagine the possibility for other legal medications and substances. How about alcohol, for instance? It is well established that people die every year in alcohol-related motor vehicle accidents. Or how about, maybe you know, maybe you don't, that there is a nutrition supplement, apparently, that blocks the ability of anyone who's doing your analysis on someone who is taking marijuana. It blocks their ability to actually figure that out. So they are shielded from discovery. So is it possible, and would you be agreeable, essentially, in requiring registration for anyone who purchases that type of nutritional supplement. And I bring this to you because I think you have to think further than meth. You have to think into the future, and you have to think about the rights of citizens. So the second thing that's of very much concern to us is the possibility that this legislation will call for or lead to calls for statewide electronic registration and tracking systems, starting with Sudafed, but then moving on. And so, as I said, the Senate already has it in their bill. And I've been informed that there's probably going to be amendments to bring it into this bill. So here's where an important question ought to be asked. What is the purpose of a log? Is it simply to inhibit would-be meth cooks from purchasing, or is it to compile data on individuals? Let me suggest that paper logs are meant to inhibit meth cooks, while electronic logs are meant to keep detailed records on individual citizens and to facilitate the eventual gathering of data from all around the state to make sure that none of us get more than our 6 grams. So finally, while I want you to know that we have some ideas we would like you to consider, particularly, and they're on your list, making the drug a prescription drug, and I realize that no one's going to like that. But if the danger is as high as stated, it might be better to make it a prescription. And if it's a prescription drug, it could be made explicit in law that standing orders from physicians are allowed, that citizens may get the 2-packet limit from their favorite pharmacy without ever having to visit a doctor. And then if you continue on the road towards requiring registration, we think it's essential that there be a search warrant required. And lest the law be interpreted otherwise, specifically prohibit within this law the creation of a statewide electronic surveillance and tracking system. We are greatly concerned that this will be only the first medication that will be tracked. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. And as I mentioned to members, we will take questions after the witness testimony. The last person on the list I have here is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister with us today? I see him. Okay, apparently he's not here. All right, we'll go back to the top of the list, members, for discussion and questions for witnesses. Do any members have questions of Mr. O'Malley from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension? Okay. Any members with questions for Ms. Diori and the realtors with respect to the A05 amendment? Ms. Diori and Mr. Parsons, if you'd come down to the table. Representative Ellison has a question. Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Ms. Diori makes her way down, should I wait for Ms. Diori to get me? Is she still here?
I think Mr. Parsons is capable of speaking to the amendment, Representative Ellison.
Well, thank you. Let me just go right there. Mr. Parsons, part of my question is because I may not fully understand what you're saying, and part of it is because, you know, I just want to get some information. But does your amendment, and I'm now looking at page 5 of the amendment at the bottom, line 34, does it include renters when you speak in terms of sellers or transferors and buyers and transferees? Does it embrace do people who come in to a rental agreement for a property get to know that it was used at a prior time as a location where meth was made?
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee. I think the common meaning of those terms in this amendment, and as it's understood in the seller disclosure law, is that it applies to a sale of property as opposed to rental of property.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in your amendment that does give protection to people who rent property where meth had been previously manufactured, to put them on the same notice as that a buyer would have?
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chairman, representatives of the committee, I don't think the portion of the bill that our amendment is directed towards did not deal with renters, and I don't think we actually addressed that issue. There certainly could be something that would require a disclosure to renters, but it wasn't in the original bill. And the feeling was that because we have a seller disclosure law, which applies to 1 to 4 family dwellings, that doesn't apply to any other property. And in the one-to-four family dwelling, it requires that one of the units be occupied by the owner as their principal residence. That it was important that this statute apply to all property across the state, warehouses, large apartment complexes, etc., vacant land.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
I do have a question for the author. Representative Johnson, is there anywhere in your bill, and you know it probably better than anybody, where renters are put on notice or there's a requirement that a landlord tell a renter, hey, you know, they were making meth here last week? Anything like that?
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Johnson.
Representative Ellison, there is not. There's the provision in the amendment that says that a piece of property that's contaminated cannot be used or occupied. So it would be violative of the bill and of the law even to do that, but there's no specific notification provision.
Okay, last question, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Ellison.
Would you be all right to include, I mean, how would you feel about including in the bill some protection for renters who may come into possession of property? And you could explain to me if this is your thoughts on this. How do you feel about renters getting some notice that, hey, they were making meth here in the recent past?
Mr. Chairman
Johnson.
Representative Ellison, I'd be willing to talk. I'd rather not do it on the fly here because I'd like to hear from the different groups that might have an interest, but I'd certainly be willing to talk to you about that.
Right.
We have three more stops. So.
But.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Yor, can you just, on page 4 of the amendment, it talks about the authority issuing an order, and then on page 5 it talks about the authority issuing an affidavit for cleanup. How does this show up if an average person were want to get information about a home? How would an average person see this without doing a title search?
Ms. Yor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad. They will not, most likely not see the affidavit unless they did a title search. That's why there is an additional disclosure mechanism put in here.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one further question, Ms. Diori. I'm looking on page 5 again, and it talks about before signing an agreement, I'm assuming that the purchase agreement, to sell the property they have to disclose. And then on page 6, it says that unless the buyer unless the seller has agreed to the contrary before the closing. So here we've got a gap there between the time of the purchase agreement and the time of closing. In that time, I think the amendment goes on to say that a buyer can get money for remediation. What happens if that buyer just says, hey, you know, between the signing of the purchase agreement and the disclosure before the time of the sale, what if that buyer just says, hey, I don't want to buy this property, even though it's been cleaned up, I want out? Is there still an avenue for the buyer to do that, to cancel that agreement?
Ms. Diori.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that's a good question. I don't believe that a buyer would, this would not affect the ability, the terms of the purchase agreement, and I believe we have specific language in this legislation or in the amendment that states that it would not affect the transfer of the property. So if a prospective buyer was provided a disclosure by the seller prior to a purchase agreement, I think they would have some difficulty, most likely, in saying that they no longer wanted the property after they had entered into a purchase agreement. Unless they made it, of course, contingent upon their satisfaction that it's been remediated or something like that.
Okay.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just see a small gap there from a buyer perspective. If I don't know that there's a problem and it's been cleaned up, I may still not be comfortable with that cleanup process. I then don't have an ability to say, you know, I didn't have all the facts, and maybe there's a different way in terms of things set up in law in a different area that I don't know about, but it seems like there might be a gap there from an unknown purchasing perspective.
Ms. Diori, Mr. Parsons, comment?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that if a seller failed to make a disclosure as required by the statute before the purchase agreement was signed, I think that would be a basis for a buyer to say, I want out of this agreement. I think the statute, which, and this is patterned almost word for word on the well disclosure statute, because right now a seller of property where there is both a well in use or a well and not in use that hasn't been properly sealed must disclose before signing the purchase agreement. I think that the buyer would have a basis for rescinding the transaction. This language is meant to deal with if it is never disclosed and the buyer has not been given a supplemental disclosure and given an opportunity to decide what they want to do, then the buyer has legal rights to go back against that seller because they didn't disclose the existence, in this case of the lab or in the case of the well or the well.
Okay.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't belabor it. I understand that piece of it. I'm just wondering if there is a window of opportunity where a seller may not know until after the purchase agreement is signed, and I still wanted to know whether the buyer has recourse at that point before closing. So I may be misunderstanding a piece of your explanation, but it seems to me that if they know about it, absolutely there would be recourse, but what if they find out about it 5 days into closing? That's my question.
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it would be a judgment call as to the materiality. In some cases, it would give a buyer a basis for walking away, and in other cases, it might not rise to that level. It would probably have to be dealt with on an individual basis. The seller disclosure law has the same sort of a gap with respect to supplemental disclosures that occur after the agreement is signed and before closing, as does the existing well disclosure statute.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Johnson, thank you for your hard work on this. This is a very good bill and something I know you've worked very hard on. In my community, particularly in the Stillwater area, we have what I understand a peculiar problem or a particularly large problem with teenage use in meth and with home cooking. And we've seen really rapid growth in teenage use and home cooking. And I see this bill as a very good way to handle both of those problems at the same time. I spoke with a woman from Washington County who deals with juveniles and talked about the rapid expansion of home cooking and also with the teenagers that she sees, their on-ramp to meth use is buying in the stores, or is commonly known as smurfing, and that's the on-ramp to addiction. And I think that this will go a long way to do that. The one question I had is, in dealing with this, I noticed that the products that are still will be available to folks who want to go in and buy them for the convenience sake. Had you looked at all at banning entirely, going essentially to the next step as a mechanism for dealing with this?
Chairman,
Representative Dean, I have a little bit. Recently, because that opinion is starting to bubble up a little bit as I'm talking to legislators actually from both sides of the aisle who have said, you know, if this is as serious a problem as you say it is, and it clearly is, maybe we should just ban those pseudoephedrine products that can easily be made into meth and still allow these others to be out on the market. It's an option. We haven't looked at, you know, whether there are certain legal issues with respect to that, but it's something that's in the back of my mind at least.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions for Ms. Diori or the realtors with respect to the A05 amendment? Representative Hilty, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Johnson, there in the amendment, there are a number of references to work that the contractor would do cleaning up the site. Is there any provision in the bill or in current law that would provide for a check on the contractor's work? Is the Department of Health responsible for making sure that the work that presumably has been done is in fact done, or do we just take the contractor's word for it?
Chairman Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, there is no check There is no agency, for example, that is responsible for checking on the contractor in this bill. But if a landowner or a property owner were to learn later that the affidavit or the verification that was filed was inaccurate or false, then they would have a claim back. But there is no specific provision saying that this particular agency or the Department of Health is responsible for that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hilty.
Representative Johnson, is that a question that you have considered? Because this is very complex, and the nature of the remediation would be very complex. And I don't know how a landowner would really have any means of knowing that what work was alleged to have been done would have been done. You know, if a contractor comes and paints your house, you can see whether it's painted or not. But in this case, I don't know how you would actually be able to verify without going to a great deal of expense whether the cleanup had actually been done in a satisfactory manner or at all.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Johnson.
And Representative Hilty, it is not an issue that I have thought about, but I would be happy to talk with the Department of Health about it more to see if they have ideas for a check there. It's a good point.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Witt? And I may have failed to mention he's with the Minnesota Bankers Association. Any questions for him? Okay. Representative Emmer.
This is for Chairman Johnson. I don't know if this works. I just want to echo Representative Dean's. Mine's more of a remark. Since you presented this in our Health Policy Committee hearing, I had a chance to look at how important or significant this issue is in Wright County, which I represent part of. The numbers are staggering, and they mirror what we've been told here, that in 1995, the Wright County Sheriff's Office seized two meth labs. In 98, it was 10. In 99, it was up to 17. In 2003, it was 17. And then the numbers were staggering, that from 95 to 2003, Wright County taxpayers spent over $350,000 for the cleanup and disposal, and that another $150,000 a year is devoted by the county attorney's office to deal with this issue. And then lastly, and probably the most significant, Representative Johnson, is that 64 children in the years 2002 and 2003 were found living in these cooking establishment or labs amongst the toxic substances. So I don't like piecemeal approaches. If something is a legitimate product and somebody is allowed to sell it, it's a legal substance. But in this case, I would encourage you to look at the total ban option.
Thank you. Chairman Johnson, comment? Thank you. Seeing no questions for Mr. Witt, did any members of the committee have questions for Twyla Braes? Okay. Representative Lesh passes. Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else here today with us who wishes to testify in favor of House File 572? Is there anyone here with us today who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 572? Seeing none, members, before we proceed to vote, is there any further discussion with respect to House File 572? Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think this is a very good bill, and obviously this is a very big problem in Minnesota. But my question to you is, this bill obviously seems to deal with the issue of meth that we're having locally and with cooking locally and with local drug stores. But my understanding is the proportion of really, if you will call it meth deals that are happening in Minnesota, is there's a much higher proportion that are coming from outside the state. Could you comment on that and tell us maybe, does this bill address that at all?
Chairman Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Slawick, you are correct. That's, you know, I've seen different stats, but maybe 70 to 80% of the meth use in Minnesota comes from the outside. This bill deals with the whole meth picture, but it really concentrates on the labs and trying to put an end to meth labs in Minnesota. And this isn't going to put an end to it, but it certainly will take a big chunk out of it. And there may be more that we need to do in the future to deal with what is coming in from the outside. What is coming in from the outside happens to be much less pure. My understanding is what you could cook at home is going to be 75 to 90% pure. What you're going to get on the street from Mexico or from California is, you know, more like 20, 30, 40% pure. So what people are making in their homes is much more dangerous. But you also get the fact that these meth labs are out there and they're putting kids and vulnerable adults into danger as well. So I think it's a point well taken that this is a much bigger problem than what this bill itself can deal with, but this is really directed towards the labs themselves.
Sure.
Representative Slawik.
I think that is what your bill is addressing. I just encourage you to look at that when you look at the proportions, and obviously the labs are the most highly visible, and I also represent Washington County and know that that is a big issue and have seen presentations out there. My other question is about the treatment portion of the bill. Are you how much have you looked at that and what's happening with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik.
Chairman Johnson.
I looked at it quite a bit, and actually we discussed it quite a bit in health policy and a little bit in public safety as well, and I assume we'll discuss it more going forward. The treatment provision in here is a small. I think there's going to be about $600,000, $300,000 each of the 2 years dedicated to treatment, which is specifically directed towards some programs for mothers and pregnant women. I would love to spend more money on treatment because just putting someone in jail for a period of time isn't necessarily going to solve their meth addiction. And treatment it works as long as we do it right. It's long-term, it's very expensive, and I'm hopeful next year if we have a little more money at our disposal, I can come back and ask for a portion of that in further treatment.
Thank you.
Members, I would note that on the agenda today as well, we do have Senate File 959, Representative Hilty, and House File 226, Representative Smith. It is my full intention to weigh and consider and vote upon both those bills before our appointed adjournment time, so I beg your cooperation. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be quick. Representative Johnson, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I also want to thank you for coming to my community of Lee Center to do a town hall meeting and talk about and actually really listen to the concerns of public health, of corrections, of our judicial branch and law enforcement in my communities in terms of the effect that this has not only on the costs, but also on the human costs. And so I appreciate your time in doing that. This is really something that it's not rural, it's not metro. It's one of those issues that we all can get our arms around and get behind in terms of trying to help curb some of the production of meth in the state of Minnesota. So thank you for bringing it forward. And members, I sure hope that we can unanimously get this through to the next committee so we can help solve this problem.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. O'Malley that I thought of, but while he comes down to the author, is there anything, I talked to you earlier about possibility of pharmacy clerks, and is that something that's still being entertained? I understand the Senate put that language in, and what's your plans on that?
Because Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom.
Representative Johnson.
And I apologize because I was not able to get that language in time for this meeting, but what I would like to be able to do is track what the Senate passed, and in the bill that they passed, they included pharmacy clerks in their definition of who was allowed to sell the pseudoephedrine products. So I would like to be able to do that. I'm not sure exactly what that definition means yet, but I'll find out.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative Westrom.
Mr. O'Malley, just a question. If we take this off the streets, I understand they use ammonia and other products. Are most of those useless if this product isn't out there, or why is this the key product that needs to be regulated and strictly supervised?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, you're absolutely correct. The other ingredients needed to go through the cook process to turn to make methamphetamine, there are a number of substitutes for those other products. There is no substitute for pseudoephedrine. If there is no pseudoephedrine, there can be no methamphetamine.
See, Mr. Chair,
Representative
Mr. O'Malley, you haven't seen any other product that's coming along that seems to replace this, or we just going to have another product 5 years from now that we have to ban, or maybe that's too futuristic to tell. But
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, there are other products that contain pseudoephedrine, but pseudoephedrine is the key product needed for the manufacturing process. For example, these products up here contain pseudoephedrine. We have not found a lab in Minnesota that has ever used these products. We are trying to draw a very reasonable balance between what's really essential and not make it overly cumbersome for others. There are other products out there unrelated to the medical, human medical environment that have pseudoephedrine in them. Those are already restricted in certain ways, so there are other products out there. But again, the goal was to not go any further than was necessary, but to go far enough to prevent this.
Okay. One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Westrom.
What's so expensive, or what's the cost to clean up, and why? I hear numbers in the thousands. What is it that's critical when they're cleaning that gets to be expensive, cleaning up a house or a property that's had meth made in it?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I don't know that an average really captures the cost of a meth cleanup. There are some labs that have been there for a long time, and in fact, there was a motel that just had to be condemned, had to be raised. You could not clean it up. Other times, if small amounts are made for a brief period of time, the cleanup may be as inexpensive as a few thousand dollars. I would think on average in Minnesota, cleanups are in the range of $6,000 or $7,000. The reason being, and that's just the pure cleanup, that isn't necessarily the training of the law enforcement officers and others. The reason being that there are hazardous materials that need to be disposed of, and we have a contract with the private vendors that are equipped through OSHA to come in and do that and take those products. Also, the cost of going in and the equipment that law enforcement officers have to wear, the safety equipment, that's all very expensive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further discussion of House File 572? Seeing none, Representative Johnson will renew his motion that House File 572, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred on the Committee on Commerce and Financial Institutions. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed say no. The motion prevails. The bill is re-referred. Next on the agenda is Senate File 959. Representative Hilty. Good afternoon, Representative Hilty. What's the path for this bill? Where are we taking it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have had a couple of different thoughts about that. The bill passed in the Senate independently, but I understand there might be some intention on the part of the chairman of the committee to hold this bill over for inclusion in an elections omnibus bill.
Okay, what we'll do then for this afternoon, Representative Hilty, is we'll lay this bill over for potential inclusion in the omnibus bill, and if it's decided at a later date that it should move independently, we can obviously move it as such. So Representative Hilty moves that Senate File 959 be considered by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus elections bill. Representative Hilty, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What this bill does, and we can consider this very briefly, I think. At the end of last session, the omnibus elections bill included a provision for a post-election audit of the electronic voting equipment used in Minnesota in order to ascertain that the tallies recorded electronically corresponded with those that would be obtained in a hand recount. That was the House position in the conference committee, and the Senate acceded to that, except that there was some question about whether this provision was really necessary, and so there was a sunset that was put on the post-election audit provision sort of at the last minute. Since then, I think we've reached pretty general consensus that, in fact, this is a very necessary provision, since it doesn't matter how many paper trails you have in an electronic voting situations if you don't use them for something. So I did have conversations with the very people in the Senate that had objections to this provision in the last go-round, and I think they finally seen the light, Mr. Chair, because it was the Senate author was the person that had the most doubts about it in the last session. So that explains the repealer, and the other thing that the bill does is that this was my provision originally, and it had been my intention that any post-election audit would only apply to major races in the state. The bill as it passed said each review is limited to federal and state offices. We thought that was clear enough at the time, but in retrospect, it could also be seen to apply not only to presidential, Senate, congressional, and state legislative races, but to judgeships and other races. And so the language in the bill, which is on lines 12 through 14, merely clarifies that. That was something that the county auditors and elections officials across the state were concerned about, and this is just intended to allay those concerns. And that, Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Questions for the author? Discussion of the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hilty renews his motion that Senate File 959 be laid over for potential inclusion in the Omnibus Elections Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Next on the agenda is House File 226. Chairman Smith, welcome back.
Chairman, thank you.
Good afternoon. My understanding, Chairman Smith, is that this bill is going to your committee next. Is that true?
Chairman, that would... I hope it's a motion, yes.
All right, that'll be my motion. The chair will move House File 226, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Smith, do you have any author's amendments for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment styled H.O. 226A1.
Okay. Chairman Smith, to your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, this was presented by Deb McKnight of your staff. I believe it's for cross-referencing purpose. And therefore technical. No objection to that amendment, obviously.
Okay. Any questions of the author, Ms. McKnight, with respect to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The author now has the bill in the form in which he'd like to present it. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. The Minnesota legislature passed legislation in 1981 dealing with parental notification. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless parents are given 48 hours notice or the minor receives permission from a court for that abortion. In other words, a judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be mature and capable of giving informed consent, or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, such as in the cases of abuse. This parental notification bill, House File 226, would allow the legislature to monitor how effectively the notification law is being implemented. That's a general statement, and I'd like to very briefly walk you through the bill subdivision by subdivision. On page 1, subdivision number 1, abortion notification data, the Commissioner of Health shall prepare the reporting form for use by physicians and facilities performing abortions. The reporting form would require inclusion of information such as the number of minors or women for whom a guardian has been appointed, the number of notices provided personally, number of notices provided by mail, the number then who went on to obtain the abortion from the reporting physician or reporting facility. The additional information would include the number of minors or women for whom a guardian has been appointed, the number who were emancipated minors, the county the female resided in, resides in, and if a judicial bypass is obtained, it would include additional information such as the age and race of the female, the process the physician or the physician's agent used to inform the female of the judicial bypass, whether court forms were provided to her, whether the physician or the physician's agent made the court arrangement for the female, and how soon after visiting the abortion facility the female went to court to obtain the judicial bypass. On page 2, subdivision 2 requires the physicians obtain those reporting forms from the Minnesota Department of Health. Same page, subdivision 3 requires the Department of Health to obtain as confidential data information that would identify the woman having the abortion to be made by April 1 of each year. In other words, a reporting requirement yearly by April 1. Going on, page 3. Under subdivision 4, there's a provision if there's a failure to report, and that would subject, if the report is not submitted, if the reports are not submitted more than 30 days following the due date, there would be a late fee penalty of $500. Further, if a report was more than 1 year old or following that due date, the Commissioner of Health could bring an action in court to compel the physician or the facility to so submit. You'll notice on page 3 down lines 30 through 32, it makes private the data that would reasonably lead to the identification of the individual. In other words, this data submission bill, we're dealing with aggregate data, not personal data. Going on page 4, requires that under subdivision 5, requires that by September 30 of each year, the Commissioner of Health shall issue a public report providing the aggregate data, which would include the total number of petitions, the number of cases where a guardian ad litem was appointed, the number of cases in which the court has appointed counsel, the number of cases in which the judge has issued an order authorizing an abortion without notification, including the number of petitions where there was a finding of maturity and the basis for that finding. Additional information would include number of denials for which an appeal was filed, the number of appeals that resulted in a denial being affirmed, and the number of appeals that resulted in the reversal of a denial. There's some additional subdivision 6 that speaks to modification of requirements allowing the Department of Health to modify reporting dates. There's under subdivision 7, there's a suit to compel a statistical report allowing a group of 10 or more citizens to seek an injunction requiring a report be filed per the bill. And then subdivision 8 is one dealing with attorney fees. And then subdivision 9 is a severability clause that any part of the bill is found unconstitutional, any valid provisions are intended to remain in effect. That's the walkthrough of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Did you want to move to your testifier right away, or did you want to answer questions?
We can move to the testimony right away.
All right. Is it Ms. Giese?
Yes.
Could you please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Giese, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization of more than 77,000 member families and 241 chapters. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I come before you to urge you to pass House File 226, the Parental Notification Data Bill. I'll keep my comments brief, and you may find them somewhat redundant of what Representative Smith has already said. The Minnesota legislature passed a parental notification law in 1981. and that was later upheld by the United States Supreme Court. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless her parents are given 48 hours notice or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion. And this process is referred to as the judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be mature and capable of giving informed consent, or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest. Representative Smith said, as in cases of abuse. House File 226, the Parental Notification Data Bill, would provide a monitoring mechanism for how effectively the bypass part of the parental notice law is being implemented. It will also enable the state to be aware of counties overburdened with the judicial bypass procedures. Minnesota has already determined that the state has an interest in trying to involve parents in their minor daughter's abortion. So it would only naturally follow that the state has an interest in making sure that this important law is working. On behalf of MCCL, its 241 chapters and 77,000 member families, please support House File 226. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Oh, Mr. Chair, we'll try to answer any questions if there are any.
Other questions for the author or Ms. Deasy? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chairman Smith, thanks for the bill. I think that in principle, the idea of more information and monitoring information is a good one. Excuse my voice, I'm a little hoarse here. But I do have some concerns about how sweeping some of these provisions are. And if I could just turn your attention briefly to subdivision 5 on page 4 of the bill. I see here that starting on line 8, the bill would require that the Department of Health obtain certain information from various court administrators. And I assume that in so doing, the department would be able to trace which courts, in particular by judicial district or by county, were granting or not granting judicial bypasses. Am I reading that correctly?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, if I understand your question, I think so. If you want to go a little further, go ahead.
Well, sure. I'm wondering whether or not, and I know it's procedurally too late today, but generally speaking, would you have any objection to making this aggregate data sort of judicial district blind? In other words, what if you accepted an amendment that said instead of that the information should be obtained from court administrators, it said obtained from the state court administrator? Sue Dosal currently holds that position, and maybe this is something that could be compiled and submitted so that we would know on an aggregate basis how many in Minnesota were or were not granted, but not by judicial district and not by county. Would that be acceptable to you in theory?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, maybe in theory, in practice, I'm not so sure. For several reasons, none of which are in order of their importance, but it strikes me that one of the reasons for this bill is to do what, well, the main reason for the bill is to do what apparently wasn't done in 1981 as a general practice, and that's build performance measures into statutes where we require something to be done or to not be done, see how effective, so the legislature can have a report back and see how effective it is. This is a particularly important area of the law that the legislature passed this bill in 1981. It strikes me that the state is broken into separate judicial districts. We treat them differently on occasion. For example, with the state takeover, that was done in phases. I think in order to be aware of any districts, or even counties perhaps, but certainly districts that are overburdened, it's maybe an overreaching word, but if there are any judicial districts that are overburdened by the judicial process outlined in the bill, then I think it would be important for the legislature to know that as well. And the final thing I would say, the current or the next chair of the Judiciary Finance Committee might choose to start line iteming where money goes in the court's budget rather than just turn over a lump sum, so that if there is an 8th or a 9th judicial district that requires special attention relative to resources to implement the 81 law, then we would have the ability to direct that as well.
Is that Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Smith. My other set of questions pertains to the other reporting requirement, that by the physicians or the clinics, and I'm looking specifically at the top of page 2, which would be subdivision 1, sections or paragraphs numbered 2 and 3. What caught my eye in reading these provisions was that it seems to ask facilities and maybe physicians personally to admit to illegality, essentially. It asks, for example, on line 4, for physicians to say, well, how many times did you do this without notice? Similarly, in paragraph number 3, it seems to ask physicians or facilities to admit how many times was certain information not provided, lines 12 and 13. And it seems to me, and please tell me if you think I'm off base here, it seems to me somewhat the equivalent of having a line on a tax return that says how many of the deductions you claimed are false. How is that analogy not a true one? And is it, and I guess the second part of the question would be, do you think there might be a better approach rather than having these institutions or individual physicians have to admit to illegality? Or am I reading it wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I respectfully suggest you may be reading it wrong. I'm not looking to give the legislature collectively a cause of action for failing to give notice. I'm only looking for an aggregate set of data that gives the legislature the ability to monitor numbers, not people, but numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, furthermore, within those sections, the information regarding the notice that is being requested, there is the judicial bypass option in place, and so there is the option for young women to go through that procedure. It is not illegal for that procedure to take place. That is part of the parental notice law that was passed in 1981.
I see. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. So maybe I did misunderstand. You're just saying that this is only for, in other words, this may be one route that the physician or facility didn't take, but it's not necessarily forcing them, is what you're saying. It's not necessarily forcing them to call out or identify their own unlawful behavior. Is that true?
Representative Johnson, Chairman Johnson, Representative Simon, hopefully there is no illegal or action being taken. It's just aggregate data on which procedure in law the girl decided to take.
Mr. Chair, we're past our committee time, and we still, I know there's at least one testifier on the other side, and there's still numerous questions about this bill. I'm just wondering how we're going to proceed here.
Representative Slawick, I would like to keep moving. Obviously, if we go past a certain time, we will need to leave, or if our committee starts to disappear, but I don't have anyone else on the list of questioning. I do have Natalie Gottesman as a person to testify. So I'd like to call you up now, Ms. Gottesman, if you would, and then we'll take more questions, and if we run out of time, we will lay the bill open. Ms. Gottesman, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, my name is Natalie Gottesman. I'm a resident of Edina. I am a guardian ad litem volunteer in Hennepin County, and it is in that capacity that I'm here to oppose House File Number 226. I'm not speaking for the court, for court administration. I've been a guardian ad litem for nearly 8 years. I've been a guardian ad litem for young women seeking judicial bypasses for 5 years. During that time, I have both been very conscientious in my duties, and I'm impressed with the judges before whom I have appeared in Hennepin County. I chose to become a guardian ad litem because of my love for children. As a mother, I worry about the future generation and have felt that being a court-appointed guardian ad litem for children who are needy affords me a way to make a meaningful contribution to enhancing their lives. Since all of you may not be fully aware of the process, I'd like to briefly describe it. In Minnesota, young women who are under 18 years of age and not able to obtain signatures of both parents prior to abortion procedures are required to appear before a judge to obtain a judicial bypass. It's the judge who makes the final determination of whether the young woman is mature and mentally competent enough to make this decision. Prior to appearing before the judge, a guardian ad litem conducts an interview with the woman. These young ladies come seeking judicial bypasses following their physical examination and counseling at the facility where they will be having their abortion should they so choose. The most common reasons given for not confiding in both parents are that they don't have contact or relationship with one of their parents, one or both parents are deceased, their parents would not agree with their decision, one or both parents have chemical or psychological problems that have resulted in the young woman being their caretaker. Parents have threatened to toss them out of the house if they ever get pregnant or even have premarital sex. There are cultural barriers, or they simply feel that they've made a mistake that they feel they should be taking responsibility for rather than disappointing their parents. I complete a 3-page questionnaire which asks questions regarding the young woman's general health, the counseling she was given at the facility where she will be having her procedure with regards to the process, aftercare, physician liability, and most importantly, her alternatives to having an abortion, her reasons for feeling an abortion is her personal best choice, whether there has been any coercion relating to her decision, how long she's been thinking about her decision, why she's not informing either one or both of her parents, and if there is any additional information she feels the court should be made aware of. I also try to determine whether she has an adult who has or will be supportive of her following the abortion. And in the rare instance where she has not identified anyone, we work on how she will go about that so that I feel comfortable she will have either a trusted adult or professional in whom she can confide if she feels the need. I also am very careful to explain to each young woman that if the judge signs a bypass for her, it should be considered comparable to a parent permission slip, allowing her the freedom to make up her mind as to what she feels is best for her in this situation. I make it very clear that she is not to consider the judge's signature a court order, but merely a document indicating that the judge has determined she is mature and mentally competent to make this decision without the signatures of both of her parents. Following this interview, I appear before the judge with the young woman, giving a description of her answers to my interview and my impressions. The judges, without exception in my experience, have been very professional and conscientious during these hearings. This is by no means a rubber stamping process. They always ask the young woman a few additional questions. The most popular one is their plan going forward so that they don't become pregnant again. They also repeat the instructions that their signature is not granting the young woman permission to go get an abortion, but a finding that they are competent to make their own independent decision about what they want to do. Both my interview and the judge's hearing are conducted with the young woman alone. This is so that in the event that there is any coercion going on, the young woman has 2 opportunities to confide that information. Court reporters record the hearings. These current procedures utilized for judicial bypass appear to me to be very appropriate and thorough. I'm at a total loss to understand what the motivation behind and purpose are for the proposed legislation. At a time when our legislature is grappling with finding funding for so many fine existing programs, particularly in the areas of healthcare and education, it seems ludicrous to me as a taxpayer to be adding an additional burden to taxpayers simply for the exercise of data collecting in one additional way.
Thank you, Ms. Gottesman. Any questions for the witness? Representative Hilty.
My question is not for the witness, Mr. Chair. It's for the author.
All right. Representative Smith. Actually, Representative Hilty, Representative Emmer has a question for the witness. Go ahead, Representative Emmer.
Ma'am, in your capacity, do you also help the young ladies that you're assisting apply for Minnesota Care? Is that something that you would also be involved in?
No.
So, if you don't help them, but you understand that some of the ladies that you help do take advantage of Minnesota Care?
Ms. Gottes.
You know,
No. I mean, I know that they... no, I actually... I don't. We don't discuss finances. My job as a guardian ad litem is not to find out whether or not they can pay their bill. My job is just to be sure that I feel that they're competent to make a decision, as I understand it.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me how many folks over the last, I forget how many years you said you've been doing this, five, I think?
Mm-hmm.
How many young ladies over the last 5 years have you assisted through this process? And then if you could just follow up and tell us what is the youngest age that we're dealing with and how many of those were in fact denied?
Ms. Gottesman.
I can't speak for the office. You know, for Hennepin County, I can speak from my own personal experience, and I had one. I personally have had one denied. What was the other?
How many are we dealing with over your past 5 years? How many young ladies that have gone through? You've taken through this process, and what is the youngest age that we're dealing with?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and personal members, the youngest person that I dealt with was about, I think she may have been 12. She was there. She came with her mother. I believe she was 12. She was there with her mother, and my recollection is that there was no father available or something. And that would be the youngest. And I personally have experienced one denial.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Out of how many?
I have no idea.
Are we dealing with hundreds?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't think so. Not me personally.
Any other questions for Ms. Gottesman? All right, Representative Pilkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, recognize that this is not a finance committee, but is there a fiscal note with this bill? I think the last time we saw this bill was approaching $500,000. I was just wondering.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I haven't seen one this year, but by the time the finance committee deals with it, it'll be in. So I don't know the answer right now.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking for that is that Representative Smith, you're certainly more aware than most of the burdens that we already have on our court system and the struggles that we have to keep up and keep an adequate number of employees and judges to meet the demands that we already have. And don't you have any concern about putting additional demands on the court system, particularly at this time?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, yes, I do, and that'll have to be weighed in the process. If you're looking at it with a cold eye towards money to be divided among various line items, then we'll have to weigh this one if it gets to the committee that I chair and weigh the merits of monitoring a bill that was passed in 1981 to give parents the right to be informed, with certain exceptions that would require a judge's bypass. So we'll have to see.
Senator Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I please request a roll call on this one? Thanks.
Roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fowler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, obviously I just want to comment on the age and then ask a question, but on the age issues, potentially there are incest issues, rape issues. I mean, why these young ladies can't go to their parents. I always think of how difficult a decision this must be for any young woman, particularly a very young woman between the age of 12 and 18. Why do you think, Representative Smith, this bill is necessary when Minnesota already has two other reporting and record-keeping laws? There was a report the legislature passed in 1999 and the 24-hour waiting period we passed in 2003.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Follick, I think this bill answers and provides the needed oversight of a 1981 law. That's the most important thing this legislature does, is oversee things. and I think it's in the best interest of the parents and their minor daughters.
Seeing no, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, those study bills come through, or bills to gather information come through. Before I got in the legislature, I remember there was a bill on racial profiling. I got a bill like that now. And we wanted to collect data because we suspected that there was an abuse going on. And we would be happy to find out that there wasn't one, but we wanted to know because we had some anecdotal information that there was. What's the objective of this data collection bill? Do you suspect that there's abuse going on in this case? Is that the idea behind the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I didn't hear that. Do I suspect abuse?
Yeah, that's my question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I'm only going to repeat. This bill does two things. It does what should have been done in 1981, put into the original legislation the tracking devices necessary to provide the legislature with its ability to oversee a bill that, secondly, is in the best interests of parents and their minor daughters.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ellison.
My hearing's fine, Mr. Representative Smith. I heard what you said, but when you're collecting data, it seems to me that there is an objective in mind, and what I'm asking you is, do you believe that judges are granting judicial bypasses in instances where they should not be? Is that what's driving this bill?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I don't think either one of us could speculate on that. I think we should have the numbers so we can tell as a legislature. I don't choose to speculate. If you do, feel free to do so.
Mr. Chair, but I mean, this bill is here for a reason. Obviously, there's going to be an expense and burden to the courts. And I guess my question is there some wrong that you think this information is going to help vindicate?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll wait until the bill passes and we have a reporting date.
Last question, Mr. Chair. You've asked to collect race data here, and I'm wondering why that is important.
Representative Smith?
I think it was a fit. You mentioned wanting to do that in another bill. I think this is a well-rounded bill.
I thought it was the last question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Ellison.
Well, I mentioned it in another bill because we thought that people of color were being stopped on the streets of this, on the roads of this state when they should not have been. Do you suspect that there's a? Are you suggesting that there's a that this is a similar situation with this bill of yours?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, no.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative De La Forest renews his motion that House File 226, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety Committee, and a roll call has been requested.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Ellison?
Nope.
Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Blesch?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Slawick?
No.
Representative Westrom?
Yes.
Representative Broad?
Yes.
Representative De La Forest?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes. The motion prevails on a vote of 7-5. Seeing no further business, we are adjourned.